This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. October 11th was Indigenous Peoples Day, a day to celebrate the history, culture, and impact of Native American people. It's recognized by a handful of cities in Indiana, and last week, President Biden became the first president to commemorate the day. Today, we'll spend the hour speaking with members of the Native American community in Indiana. We'll learn about the history and culture of one tribe in the state and talk about the unique issues Native people face today. With us now is Sally Tuttle, member of the Choctaw Tribe of Oklahoma. Welcome to the program, Sally.
Thank you for having me. It is an honor and a pleasure. I'm going to go over a little bit of the history of when I came here. I am a guest of the Miami Territory, and so I want people to know what struggles have been going on for the last 30 years. To start off with is in 1978, I decided to go back to school and found out that the nearest program to support Native American Indians in the state of Indiana was in Chicago, Illinois. At that point, when I applied for assistance with education, I was denied. So I went ahead and went back to school at Ivy Tech. And before long, I was teaching for the UAW Training Center. In 1985, the Chicago Indian Center came to me and asked me to start teaching computer technology for Native American people in the state of Indiana. So I started doing that. And in 1989, I realized that our grant that was paying for this computer technology training went to Milwaukee, and Milwaukee was taking over in 1989, and all of a sudden I became the director for the Indian Center, and I had 1 year to prove that Indiana needed its own program separated from Chicago. So in that year's time, I opened up 5 offices throughout the state, one in Indianapolis, one in Peru, one in Fort Wayne, one in Maryville, and one in Evansville. So in proving that, in 1991, we got permission to temporarily, under the guidance of Milwaukee, to receive the grant and start our own program. So in 1992, for the first time in Indiana, there was a Native American Indian Center in the state of Indiana. I was there until 1996, and in the same time frame, I also was appointed to the Governor's Native American Indian Council under the Department of Natural Resources. In 1998, I realized that council could not meet the needs of the Native American Indian people, and all we could handle were things such as grave repatriation, but it didn't handle things like family services, workforce development. There were several things that we could not do. So my next mission was to create a Native American Indian Commission that could handle all of the other issues that concern Native people in the state of Indiana. I was told several times that will never happen in the state of Indiana. There is no way you'll ever get a commission. So in 1990, we started lobbying for a Native American Indian Commission. And with the help of Senator Walker, guiding us and telling us what we needed to do. Over Christmas break in 1990, we created a commission language, a statute for the Native American Indian Commission. We have a very unique commission because we have the Department of Correction, Department of Higher Ed, the Department of Health, Department of Family Services, Department of DNR, Department of Education, Workforce Development. We have a same senator and a representative. We have a minority senior and a minority representative. Plus, we have 9 Native American Indians sitting on the commission. We handle all of the issues that concern Native American Indians in the state of Indiana. So to let people know, there has been progress. It's been slow, but there has been progress. Currently, we're looking at trying to make sure that stereotyping throughout the state of Indiana is addressed, and that we also serve our people the best that we can. We have a scholarship, and I'm sure Lisa is going to be talking about the scholarship programs and the other programs that we do throughout the state during the year. But we're a very active group. Even during COVID, we didn't let things shut down. We've hosted several different notable Native American Indians around the country as the commission, and we do online programs. So there's a lot of things that we do within the state, and I'm very proud to be the vice chair of the commission, and that I still remain on the commission and remain active in making sure our Native American Indian people are served.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot that you've been able to do, but as you said, it took some time to get there. What have you seen in the difference of from when you first came to Indiana to now? How has the landscape for the Native American community changed?
I think it has changed a lot because if you knew the history of Native American Indian people, back in the early 70s, clear up into the mid 80s, not everybody claimed to be Native American Indian. And then when the 90s came around, people started coming out of the woodwork and saying, yeah, I'm Native American Indian, or I'm a descendant of a Native American Indian. 2000, again, it grew again. So when I first came here, it was a little over 9,000 people that claimed to be Native American Indian. And now we're almost at 50,000 that claim to be Native American Indians. So those numbers reflect not only the interest, but the pride at being a Native American Indian in Indiana.
What do you think led to the change for folks to feel comfortable to come out and say that they were Native American?
Well, I think, number one, it was the movies. There's more movies about Native American Indians that are probably a little more factual. I mean, there's still the Hollywood stereotyping in it, but Dances with Wolf was a big one. And now we have movie makers and producers and actors. So I think that leads to a lot of, hey, it may not be so bad to be Native American Indian.
And when we talk about President Biden's declaration or proclamation to commemorate Indigenous Peoples Day, what does that mean to your community? Or is that just something that's just like, okay, he said that, but there's more that needs to be done?
Yes, I think every state needs to recognize it. Indiana has not recognized it yet. I know there's a few cities, including Kokomo, that have recognized it. But the biggest thing for me is that Columbus is going to take a back seat, since my ancestors and many of the other tribal ancestors were here way before Columbus set on the shores in Plymouth. So I think that needs to be magnified and it be more widely known about, I mean, for the simple fact that the Constitution is based off of the Iroquois Confederacy. And, you know, there's so much of American history that is currently still in place and that is based off of Native culture.
And you mentioned, you know, that 1992 was the first time there was a Native American center here in Indiana. That wasn't that long ago when we think about it. And it's kind of shocking that it took that long for something to be recognized here. What do you think you want to see moving forward?
What I would like to see moving forward is some of the stereotyping in the state. People still think it's an honor, but they don't have kids growing up with questioning why are they doing some of the things that they do. The other thing is I think that we need every city to recognize Native American Indian Month and Indigenous Day. I think every city needs to recognize it. I know it's a national holiday, but we still have so many cities still calling it the Columbus Day holiday. And I don't want to take away Columbus, but I want it to also include Indigenous.
And when you talk about recognition of this day, before we wrap up, how did you recognize yesterday?
Well, yesterday I just sent notes to my kids and said, and my grandkids, and said, don't forget, this is Indigenous Day. This is about you and me and your ancestors. This is about the troubles that they went through, the removal, the relocation. It's all about what Native people have gone through over the last, 539 years. So I just wanted them to know that this was something that was recognizing them as a Native American Indian. I also sent it out on Facebook. So,
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you taking the time with us this afternoon. Sally Tuttle is a member of the Choctaw Tribe of Oklahoma. After a quick break, we'll talk about efforts to preserve the history and culture of the Miami Tribe in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Yesterday was Indigenous Peoples Day, a day to celebrate the history and culture of Native Americans. It's recognized by a handful of cities in Indiana. And last week, President Biden became the first president to commemorate the day. Today, we'll spend the hour talking about the Native American community in Indiana. We're joined now by Diane Hunter, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne, and Doug Picongi, Community Programming Manager, also from the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne, talking about the culture and history of the Miami Tribe and people in Indiana. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Diane, I want to start by asking you, who are the people of the Miami Tribe for people who are tuning in and learning about this for the first time?
The Miami Tribe of Oklahoma is a federally recognized sovereign nation. Our ancestral homelands are Indiana and surrounding areas, but because of two removals, our tribe is now located in northeastern Oklahoma. But many Miami people still live in Indiana. We have over 800 citizens of our tribe in Indiana.
You mentioned the removal. Where did the Miami people live in Indiana before their removal?
Most of our villages were along the Wabash River, in the Wabash River Valley. And Fort Wayne was one of our large village areas. We had a number of villages in what has become Fort Wayne, Indiana.
And Doug, when we talk about the relationship between the tribe and the American government before the removal, what was that like?
The relationship between the tribe and the federal government, I wouldn't say combative, but definitely a battle between the tribe and the government in terms of treaties and the government constant want for our homelands. And this is something I think Diane probably could speak better to than myself.
Yeah, Diane, is there anything you can add to that?
Yes, I think that after the American Revolution, the Americans started coming onto our land, as Doug was saying, and they wanted our land and they wanted more and more of our land. And so the relationship tended to be a lot of talking about, we want your land, we want you to cede the land, and we want you to go west of the Mississippi River. We don't want just the land, but we want you out of here. And every time we say, no, 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 we're not going. So it was many years, well over a decade of that back and forth. We want your land. We want you to go. And a lot of the relationship dealt right around that whole issue.
And so what happened to the Miami tribe and its people? I see that it was something in the 1840s when this was going on.
Yes. So in 1840, we finally did sign a treaty to cede the last of our lands, our tribal lands in Indiana. And we agreed at that point to be removed to land west of the Mississippi in what is today Kansas. But we didn't want to go. And so we kept putting it off. We were given 5 years to remove, and those 5 years passed. And we were still delaying removal. And so in October of 1846, that is 175 years ago right now, the soldiers came. They forcibly took us from our villages to a prison camp in Peru, Indiana. And then on October 6th, 1846, they boarded more than 300 Miami people onto 5 canal boats at Peru and took us on the canals to Cincinnati. And then from Cincinnati on steamboats on the Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri rivers to what is now Kansas City. And then over land 50 miles to the Miami Reservation in what is today Kansas. And that was to be our new home. We lived there about 20 years, and then the U.S. government wanted us to remove again. And this time it was to northeastern Oklahoma. And that is why the tribe, the seat of our government, is in northeastern Oklahoma today after those two removals.
I mean, these are very painful memories and things to talk about. Doug, what is it like when you hear these stories?
Well, you know, having a family member on the canal boat that went west. Now, granted, when they got there, they came back in the spring. But for me, you know, it does stir emotions of, it's hard to comprehend what they were experiencing then. There's documentation of tribal citizens picking up clobs of dirt, you know, and putting it in their bags because they knew that that was the last time that they were going to be in their homelands. And that's something that's just, it's hard to imagine, to think that, you know, this is a place that you've called home since basically time immemorial, and now you're being forced to go to a place that you've never been. So it definitely draws emotion, and I get a little emotional myself as well. Yesterday, down at Miami University, they did a commemoration of that 175th removal, and there was this walk that we took from the art museum to the Miami Center, and it was a solemn walk. I know the people that I walked with, tribal citizens, very few words were said. And I think it was, you know, recognizing that there were over 300 souls that were removed from our homelands. So.
Yeah, that's definitely something that you really can't put into words, and I'm sure experiencing it. And how about the feeling of of being back to where your ancestors were, being back in Indiana where everything started?
Well, again, for my family, you know, we never left the homelands.
Mm-hmm.
And I have those connections to place. I can go to Seven Pillars and experience, you know, that connection to that place there. I can go down to, is it Jalapa, Indiana, where my family reserve was. And I have those connections to those places today. And it's something that has never been lost in my family. But yet I have relatives out in Oklahoma that have never been here. And I have one relative that one of her ancestors had married one of mine, and they are both buried in the Mishingomishi Cemetery. And she's never been here to visit that relative, to the best of my knowledge. And when I go down there, I'll snap a photo of their headstone and send it to her and just let her know that, you know, I'm visiting our relatives. So for me, you know, it's a privilege to live here in Indiana as a Miami person and as a citizen of the Miami tribe. And again, you know, I have tribal members that have come here and I've shown them these places around Indiana, and you take them to these places where our ancestors lived, and you see it on their faces. This emotion that exists, that they're making that connection to their homes. And this is something that removal created, was this disconnect between our tribal citizens and the land, or our homelands in particular. So for me, the biggest thing I really, really enjoy is when I have tribal members or tribal citizens from Oklahoma that come here, and I can see the joy in their faces and the emotion that they feel. It can be, you know, they get overwhelmed with emotion when they come to some of these places here.
Yeah, that's got to be a remarkable feeling to connect with your ancestral homeland and find where you've come from. I think a lot of people are longing to know where they're from, what are their histories, and to be able to get that firsthand must be so amazing. Diane, what about for you? What are your thoughts?
My family also was exempted from removal. We were allowed to stay when others were removed. However, one of my family members went. He was a 16-year-old boy and went on removal because he couldn't bear to see the rest of his relatives who were not exempted going. And he actually died as a result of the removal. I think about him a lot, and I think about his mother. We have a letter from his mother that she wrote after she heard that he had died. And I really can connect with her as a mother myself through her words at the loss of her son that to her was so unnecessary. It didn't have to happen, and it did. And so I connect through her as well as through the land, that, like Doug, I go to certain places and I know this is where this happened, or this is where we lived, or this is where this event was, or this place was important to us because. And it's a connection that I'm hoping, as Doug related, that more and more of our tribal citizens who live outside of Indiana, because we have 6,000 altogether and only 800 and some live in Indiana. I would love at some point if every one of them could come and experience the homeland that their ancestors left so many years ago.
And what is it that you're hoping to do with the work that you do in terms of bringing back the culture, reminding people about their history?
So much of our history got lost. One of the effects of removal is that we were separated people, we were divided people. And when that happens, our culture and our language began to go dormant. And so now the tribe is working to revitalize our language and our culture and teach our people all those things that had not been forgotten, but just were not really a part of our lives for a period of time, so that we can all connect to our ancestors who lived here in Indiana, who went on removal, or who tearfully said goodbye to our relatives who went on removal. And part of that is learning our history. Part of that is engaging with each other as Miami people and learning about not only our history, but aspects of our culture, and participating in activities that we participate in because we are Miami people.
Well, I understand, Doug, that you were trying to bring back the Miamia language that was dormant for almost 30 years. Can you tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Well, actually, I'm not the person responsible for that effort. That effort started back in the 90s when Julie Olds, the cultural resource officer, connected Daryl Baldwin, a tribal citizen, with a linguist, David Costa, who's doing his dissertation on the Miami language. And the two of them got together, and that's really where the language revitalization started. And from their efforts at the beginning of recreating the language as a spoken, the Miamia language as a spoken language, because there were extensive Jesuit documents that documented the language, but it just has not been spoken in so long. So they brought that language, so to speak, back to life. And it's one of the terms we like to use in terms of cultural and language revitalization is picking up these threads of knowledge. And that is one of the threads that was picked up, was the language. And their efforts have spurned what's now called the Miamia Center at Miami University. And that's a joint relationship or a joint project between the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma and Miami University, where the Miamia Center is the research arm for the tribe, for our culture and our language. And that's really where language and cultural revitalization has kind of taken place. What I do is I create opportunities for tribal members in Indiana to learn their culture, learn their language, and learn their history as well. So that's my little piece of this greater effort here in Indiana.
Well, when it comes to the language and being able to sort of bring it back and discuss it and learn it, what were some things that you learned, Doug, with the language? And we'll actually come back right after the break to touch up on that question. We're speaking with Diane Hunter, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne, and Doug Pikongi, the Community Programming Manager, also for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne. We're speaking about the Native American community in Indiana. And if you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're continuing our conversation with Diane Hunter and Doug Pukongi. Diane Hunter is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne, and Doug Pukongi is the Community Programming Manager, also for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne. Before the break, we asked Doug what it was like to see the language being brought back and the things he learned.
Well, so growing up, knowing I was Miami, knowing my lineage, knowing my family history, there were two things always missing, was the culture and the language. And the tribe had created a language camp. And it's initially the camp was in Oklahoma, but then they brought a camp, a youth camp, to Indiana. And my daughters were able to participate in that camp. And that's really where my language interest really took off, because I recognized that, you know, my kids could speak Miamia, and I knew that 1 week of camp was not going to instill that language in them. So, excuse me. So I took it upon myself to become a self-learner, to encourage them to not only learn the language, but become self-learners themselves. And so that's really where I started.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing that. I mean, I can tell it means a lot. And I think so many people can relate to that who have other cultures or backgrounds, you know, coming to another land or a country or somewhere, or having that taken away from you and then coming back and trying to learn it. Diane, how are you feeling about that?
I am thrilled to be learning our language. In my work, the language that I tend to learn is names of places, names of people. I give talks, so I've learned how to introduce myself. Unfortunately, I'm not in a position where I have a lot of opportunity to speak conversationally with people. And I was pretty old when I started learning the language, so I don't learn as readily as some of the young people. And yet we have young people, young children, who are beginning to learn Miamiata Wenge, the Miami language, right alongside of learning English from the very start. And I just find that so inspiring and so exciting, because it tells me that we have the potential that in maybe a couple of generations, we will once again have native speakers of our language. And I think that is it's amazing for a language that linguists said was dead and could never be revitalized. And now we are learning it and we are speaking it. And with learning the language, we can learn more about who we are as Miami people.
That's amazing, just to hear how it's being brought back and how young children are able to speak it. That's really cool. And so when we talk about the Miami culture, maybe we can talk a little bit about that. Doug, you do some stuff with your organization to promote the culture. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, so for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma, I'm responsible for, again, creating cultural opportunities for tribal citizens. And I have four events that I do every year for tribal members, spring, summer, fall, and winter. And with that, I try and point out to tribal members the ecological changes that are occurring at these times. Then we also play games. We play Paquetaha Menge, lacrosse, as a game. And then we play Sainza Wenge, the bowl game. So we have games that both young kids can play as well as adults. Our winter event, we do, again, we'll play some of our games, Sains Awenge and the Moccasin game, our Moccasin game. And we'll tell winter stories as well at our winter event. So those are some of the things that I do up there. I'll also do other events based on our community. When our community is saying, hey, this is what we want, then I try and figure out a way of doing that. And one example of that is we had community members that were really interested in learning how to make elm bark baskets. We figured out a way to harvest the elm bark and do this workshop. And I think we had to limit the number, but we had a limit of 12, and we had almost 20 people signing up for this workshop to learn how to make elm bark baskets. So that's an example of where, yes, I do 4 events throughout the year, but also I listen to our community and what they want and respond to their wants and their needs as best as I can.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, and I hate to wrap this up because I feel like there's so much more we can talk about. Diane, what is important for you for folks to learn about the Miami culture?
The most important thing for people to know about us is that we still exist. So many people will tell you that Indians and particularly Miami people are extinct, and we are a living people, and we are living right here in Indiana. We are revitalizing our culture. We're participating in our culture in a way that we hadn't for many, many years. But we've always been here. And we are not just a people of the past. We are a living people with a past.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us this afternoon. It's really been a pleasure, and I hope we can have more conversations. Diane Hunter is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne, and Doug Picongi is the Community Programming Manager also for the Miami Tribe of Oklahoma in Fort Wayne. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're joined now by Carolina Castoreno, Executive Director of the American Indian Center of Indiana, and Lisa Welch, Director of the Indiana Native American Indian Affairs Commission. And Carolina, I want to know what your thoughts were. We just heard from Diane Hunter and Doug Picongi. How do you feel hearing their stories?
So especially with what we have seen on the federal level, with President Biden recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day yesterday, I don't want to take away from that because I do feel that it is a monumental step forward. This is the first time a sitting president has, you know, gone that far to recognize it. But there is an aspect of this that feels like an empty gesture because of the fact that they have yet to abolish Columbus Day. So I do appreciate that, you know, steps are being made in the right direction. But at the same time, it almost feels performative. And I feel that we need to go the additional mile and abolish the recognition of Christopher Columbus, because not only are there all of the atrocities that are associated with his arrival to the continent, but we have to be realistic and understand that he never actually set foot on what is known as the continental United States. So there really is no reason for us to be recognizing that holiday in the first place.
And Lisa, what are your thoughts?
Hi, thank you for having me, first of all. You know, as the director of the commission, we don't really weigh in on the policies that should or should not be surrounding state holidays. Our job is more to work with policies that exist now. And actually, the person that you're talking to about Indigenous Peoples Day versus Columbus Day would be Carolina. So I definitely want to defer to her and pass the mic to her and her platform to have that conversation, because that is one that should be taking place between Native American community groups, tribal leadership, and state representatives and state government. But from the commission's perspective, you know, what you've heard during the show today can be very difficult to reconcile with, obviously. You know, Indiana is no exception to the pain that you are hearing today and the turmoil of that, of the removals that happened throughout this country. So that obviously had a tragic and profound effect on the people who originally lived here. And I think that can be uncomfortable, definitely. But if we could sit in that discomfort and move through that, what we as natives or non-natives here in Indiana are left with is an opportunity to listen and to learn and grow and to embrace a more complete story of our shared history. And I think that that ultimately empowers us to have a positive impact on our collective future. And that's what the commission seeks to achieve.
Carolina, I would like to ask you, you know, when it comes to holding space for our Native American brothers and sisters throughout the country and here in Indiana, what is it that that we as a community can do?
So I think that what's really important is recognizing what the Native community looks like on a local level. And so, you know, I actually was having a discussion with several people yesterday regarding land acknowledgments, which are also a really great gesture, really great first step. But what's important for people to understand is that it's twofold. You need to be recognizing the original people of the land that you are occupying. So I really appreciate that we were able to hear Diane and Doug's voices as, you know, citizens of the Miami Nation, because they are the original people of Indianapolis. And but it's also important to make sure that we're not discussing Indigenous people in a historic context only, and understanding what the current makeup of the Native population looks like. So with Indiana, we are a total urban Indian population because we do not have what is considered reservation land here. And so especially when we look at urban areas like Indianapolis, the makeup of Indigenous people is varied. And so we have people from all parts of the country and the continent. And so making sure that when people are trying to recognize us, that they are having both pieces of that conversation, and not continuing to put us in this kind of past tense. You know, the Miami Nation still has a presence here. The Pokagon people still have a presence here. And then we have the urban Indian community, which has quite a strong presence here, even though, you know, we have, there's the tendency to kind of push us to the margins.
Lisa, when it comes to the work that you do with the commission, are there any challenges that you're facing right now?
Yes. So we have a two-part mission, as Ms. Tuttle was talking about when she was talking about the establishment of the commission. So one part is the, you know, effort to recognize and amplify all the diverse historic and contemporary Native American cultures that were originally here in Indiana and that are represented here today. And the other one is to develop programs and recommendations that address the issues relevant to Native American Hoosiers. And we have areas of focus in things like civil rights, education, employment, housing, and health and healthcare. And one of the particular challenges when you're wanting to put programs together to address issues or to make policy recommendations to organizations or lawmakers is making sure that you have good data. So sort of a perennial challenge for us is making sure that Native Americans in Indiana are counted and that they are seen. Particularly with healthcare data, that can be a little bit of a challenge because oftentimes when people are asked to identify their race, they either, if they have partial or old Native American heritage, that they often don't have the option to check that box. A lot of times Native Americans have no other choice but to select other. And another reason why we can have a little bit of a challenge is because when you're dealing with smaller population groups, particularly with healthcare data, sometimes we have trouble obtaining that because a lot of that data with such a small group leads to people being identifiable. So there's really no way to work around those privacy issues. So one of the things that we constantly work for is to improve the data that we can get so that we can understand the issues and improve our suggestions and solutions.
Carolina, when it comes to the work that you do, are there any projects or upcoming events that we should be aware of that we can come and learn more or participate?
Absolutely. So we have a couple of things going on right now. Currently, we have a fundraiser up on our Facebook page, American Indian Center of Indiana, where we are collecting donations in recognition of Indigenous Peoples Day, but it will be up for the rest of October. All of the proceeds go to providing holiday food and kind of necessity assistance throughout November and December for Native families living in the state of Indiana. And we do this every year. So we are trying to increase the number of families we service each year. Then on top of that, we have currently joined forces with Indiana Recovery Network and We Bloom and the Recovery Cafe Network. So we are opening, we are going to be launching a recovery cafe as part of the center in November. So I will definitely keep everyone posted on the details. But essentially, it is going to, because of the fact that we have so many people in our community that face disparities with mental health, addiction, substance abuse, and then just kind of intergenerational trauma and the multiple traumas that we face as a marginalized community. Our cafe is going to be Indigenous centered, but focusing on BIPOC, so Black, Indigenous, People of Color communities, to make sure that we have a safe space and that everyone has the ability to explore their own recovery path, especially for those who are from the Indigenous community, where we tend to fall outside of kind of the faith-based structure because our culture is quite different from Western culture. So this is going to be a safe space, for marginalized communities to come and experience that. It would be really great to, you know, have people in the community come out and support and just learn how they can get more involved to help Native American people living in the state.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon. Carolina Castoreno is the Executive Director of the American Indian Center of Indiana. Lisa Welch is the Director of the Indiana Native American Indian Affairs Commission. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.